Welcome to Ira's Everything Bagel, where I talk with intriguing people about everything, their passions, pursuits, and points of view. Few who were targeted survived the Holocaust of World War II, but those who did carry stories of resilience, escape, and the determination to rebuild. These stories are invaluable and must never be forgotten. In her powerful new book, Family Treasures, Lost and Found, award-winning journalist, author, and documentarian Karen A. Frankel embarks on an extraordinary journey to uncover her parents' survival stories. With relentless curiosity, Frankel scoured the internet, pored over historical records, and traveled across Europe, piercing together the past that had long remained a mystery. Growing up, she wasn't told everything, but the truth was out there, and she found it. What she uncovered was more than just history. It was a deeply personal connection to lost family, a testament to human perseverance and a call to remember. By sharing her discoveries, Frankel hopes to inspire others to seek their own histories, honor those who came before them, and ensure that the world never forgets what it means to fight for survival and for a future free from such horrors. Family Treasures, Lost and Found is available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all the usual places. And for everything about Karen and the book, go to FamilyTreasuresMemoir.com, FamilyTreasuresMemoir.com, and FamilyTreasuresFilm.com, FamilyTreasuresFilm.com. And Karen, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Pleasure. What got you to start down this road to discovery and traveling the world and doing intensive research? What was it? What was the spark? I guess the question would be, what was the spark that led you down this path?
I had tried several times in every decade of my adult life to understand better my father, who would not talk about the Holocaust and his survival as a refugee. And each time I had to back off because it was too painful. I lost my father when I was 15, and I never got a chance to speak to him adult to adult. My mother, on the other hand, did talk about the war, and I urged her to record her oral history with the Fortunoff Video Archives at Yale University. So I knew much more about her, and she lived much, much longer than my father did. And she was very willing to talk to my sisters and me. So I had this nagging feeling of mystery and frustration because I didn't know anything about my father's side of the family. I didn't even know where my paternal grandmother had been born.
Amazing. But was your mother aware that you were going to start this journey, or was this after she passed that you then went on it?
It was after my mother passed away that I sat down in journalism mode and decided to transcribe her oral history. But she, in her own way, gave me an assignment because I had pushed her and felt very guilty afterwards that I had asked her to do the oral history, which was hard for her to do. She said, well, maybe someday you'll do something with it. So it was hanging over me.
Sure. Well, was it hard to balance the role of journalist and daughter as you traced the family history and what happened?
Yeah, I would say in the first year and a half, so I started in 2014, in the first year and a half, it was extremely painful for me because every time I learned something about my father, I missed him terribly, even though it was many years ago that I lost him. When I steeled myself, as I said, with my mother's oral history, it was easier. So I had to sort of be reserved about it, you know, emotionally and step back as a professional would. But after that, you know, interval, it became actually almost a magical, I don't want to say a treasure hunt, but quest, an investigative quest, because I was amazed at how much I was able to find out. And what also struck me was how much luck and serendipity and randomness played into finding the facts that I did.
Can you give us an example of that? The randomness, sure, or the luck?
There are two. that stand out. I'll just backpedal a little bit to say why I did this particular search. When my father died, a year after he died, my sisters and I were going through his papers, and my oldest sister held up an envelope and said to my mother, "Mom, who is Rose Frankel?" And we were in his former office off the kitchen. She was in the kitchen, and there was a very long pause. And finally, after the silence, she said, "Oh, well, you know, your father was married before he met me." And we had no idea. And
you just assumed you knew, but or that was her way of kind of minimizing the situation, I would imagine.
Yeah, she was trying to be sound casual about it, but in no way was it really. And the only thing she really added was that when he found out that she had a boyfriend who was a gangster, and that they expect him, they expected him, my father, to be a front for them, then my father wanted out immediately. And that was really all we knew. So one day, I guess it was a year and a half or 2 years into my quest, I was looking at newspapers.com, which is part of ancestry.com. And I think out of boredom, because I was a technology journalist, and I was covering cybersecurity, and I was bored with that beat, because it was always the same story about passwords and the password problem and people not, you know, people ignoring their companies, training sessions that you're not supposed to reuse your password. Anyway, I was bored, and I decided to look up Rose Frankel on newspapers.com, and up popped the feature about her and my father in Havana, he on a ship and she arguing on the dock with an anti-Semitic Jewish immigration officer. And she says, "But why can't he disembark? All of his papers are in order." And the reporter said that the officials, immigration officer said, "He can't because he's a Jew." And she said, "Yes, that was his first crime. He was born a Jew." And I stared at this by myself, you know, in front of my computer screen, and I just couldn't believe that my father's arrival in Havana was documented by a local newspaper which had headquarters in Austin, Texas. And they had sent a reporter to Havana to record what was happening in Havana Harbor. Now, it then turned out that that ship was a French ship. But there was in the harbor the very famous German refugee ship filled with Jews trying to escape Hitler that very week. So my father had to have seen this when they steamed in. He must have seen all the rowboats surrounding the St. Louis and people clamoring and waving to their relatives. And his ship and another ship, a British ship called the Orduna, and my father's was the French ship Flandre, all three ships were forced out of the harbor with their Jewish cargo and could not find ports that would accept Jews. But I did know, I actually made a mistake, because I did know one thing our mother told us, that when he got to Mexico, there was an emergency on the dock, a medical emergency. So I knew that. And we were told that he, being a young doctor, saved the life of whoever was ailing on the dock and then wrangled his way off his ship by volunteering to work in a hospital for free until his visa came through from his first wife.
What a story. You said there were two things. That was the one of happenstance and randomness and serendipity. What was the other one? You said there were two.
The other one.
Two examples, yeah.
The other one was when I went to Europe in 2016, I felt I needed to experience the neighborhoods and see for myself what cities my parents had lived in and that were important to them. So those included Krakow, where my mother was born, another small town, a small city or a large town nearby called Tarnow, which became very important in her story, Vienna, where my father went to medical school, and Lvov, which is now Lviv, Ukraine, which is where my father was born. So I went to Lviv last with great trepidation, taking the same train route that my mother and her parents took when they fled Krakow to Eastern Europe. Was very nervous about going there because the country was at war. This was the first war, the Ukraine war. And the guards on the train checked our papers, and they were huge and not communicative. And I was very nervous just because I knew that nobody in Lviv would look anything like me and that I would stand out. Anyway, we got into my grandfather's house. I had seen it online because I found a document with the address and I Googled it. And I, you know, there I was at home alone again, looking at this beautiful tiled house with majolica ceramic decorations and filigree balconies. And I knew that it was unusual because my mother said it was, but she didn't remember why. And when I saw the beauty of this house, which it then turned out was a World UNESCO heritage site, I understood partly why my father would never talk about his hometown, because it must have been very, very difficult to leave such a gorgeous city and his home. And we got in with our guide, wonderful guide named Alex Denai, who's also a historian and a genealogist, and he jiggered the lock. And we got in, and I knew
burglary, I think they call it, or breaking and entering.
I don't know what I expected, but he did that. I knew that.
Now that you named him, he's gonna the police are going to come and say, "Hey, did you do that?"
Well. You know, he's in my documentary. I say it, so I think it was okay with
him. Yeah, I want to talk a little bit in a moment about your documentary as well as the book itself, but as to why you wrote it. But let's finish up that story. This is amazing. So now he gets the lock working, unworking, and you're able to get in there. And what was your impression when you walked in?
It was the vestibule. On either side had murals that were disintegrating. They were just peeling away. And I could see the faint outline of cypress trees. And it brought me right back to two cypress trees that my parents had planted to celebrate what turned out to be their last wedding anniversary. They planted them in their summer house in Amagansett, Long Island. And the steps were wooden. They weren't, they creaked, but they weren't rickety. And we said, and Alex said, let's go up to the third floor, to the attic, because we were told by my father's brother that our grandfather had hidden in that attic. And Alex wanted to see if we could get in, but the tenant who was there was alone, and the other tenant wasn't home, and the tenant who was alone was afraid to let anybody in. So we went down to the third floor, the next floor, and a Ukrainian woman answered the door, sort of sopping wet, having just gotten out of a shower. And I pulled out my iPhone because Alex started asking her questions that I thought were really interesting and valuable, and I hoped that she wouldn't notice, and I turned it on. And she told us that she had moved in the 70s, and there were still old-timers there who remembered the war and who were eyewitnesses, and that the house had been turned into a brothel, and that there were passageways from the top floor and the basement from the house to a cabaret next door. And so the women who worked in the cabaret could bring their customers to my grandfather's house and entertain them there privately. And She said that in her apartment, she found gynecological records vouching for the good health of these women, that they didn't carry diseases so that none of their Nazi customers would get them. And from that point on, I believed everything that she said, because that kind of detail you really can't make up.
Yeah, no, exactly.
There was also, I'm sorry, a red lantern outside of that.
Yeah, the red light district anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, before we get to the book and all these other elements of your story, which again is called Family Treasures Lost and Found, were you sharing this information with your siblings as you discovered material?
Yes, and my husband. You know, when I was by myself and I discovered the house, I sent my sister's screensaver shots of it, and they just couldn't believe it. And I sent it to my cousins, my uncle, the one uncle who survived. There were three brothers, had two children, so I have first cousins, and I sent it to them, and it was such a strange thing to be alone with this. I was just bursting to share it, and everybody was, you know, I worked at home, and everybody was at work. Then when I found the article, my sisters and I could not stop just being amazed, you know, oohing and aahing that such a document existed, and wondering whether our father and Rose knew about it. I think they probably did not. And there were many other major discoveries like that.
But did you decide, though, to write the book and do the documentary? And what was it that, once you discovered some of the examples you just gave me, which were great, that was part of that process, though, of writing or researching to write the book. But you must have made a definitive decision to write a comprehensive book of your family once you started to discover bits and pieces.
Yes, there was a false start. When I felt that I had concluded most of the research and had enough to fill the gaps, I chose to write an account that was really like a historical novel. It's just that the characters were real people. They weren't fictitious characters, because I wanted to write it from an omniscient point of view. I didn't want to be part of the story, because I felt that my parents were more interesting than I was. And so the voice of the narrator was kind of amorphous, and there was no opinion. The feedback was, well, who are you? How do you feel about what you found, you know?
Legitimate question.
Yes. And so I had an editor who worked with me on that first account, the narrative nonfiction account. And she was really a memoirist and a memoir teacher. And she and one of my sisters, my middle sister, Ivy, convinced me to tell it from my point of view as a memoir. My sister said, it's a treasure hunt, you know, in many ways. And I think that people will be interested to understand how you found what you found. So as I was rewriting the narrative nonfiction account as a memoir and learning the genre, I started making the film with a friend of mine, Marcia Rock.
So the film is different. Obviously, if the film as a medium is different from a book as a medium, it's apples and oranges in a way, because you have to be much more descriptive, I think, in a book than you have to be in a film. You can, when I say descriptive, I mean, visually you can show and you can narrate. It just seems a book would be more detailed, obviously, than a documentary. But you were working on two tracks at the same time.
Yes, I didn't do very much else except that trip I told you about. To me, the memoir, once I got the hang of it, and I'll tell you what really clicked, was when my teacher said, you know, you can't just say what happened after a scene. You need to comment. There needs to be conjecture, and you can ask questions, and you know, what ifs. And once I understood that, which was so different from being a technology reporter, I got it. And I regarded it as a rewrite. And I got feedback from my class and from my teacher, who was, as I said, also the editor. And then, so, and it was in installments, you know, I had to get something ready for class on a 3-week cycle. And so the pacing was okay for me. And then we started interviewing for the film, or rather Marcia started interviewing me during COVID. There wasn't much else that we could do. And we both got COVID very, very early on. So we were recovered while other people were suffering. And that was, you know, we really got going in 2021 with that.
And when you mentioned earlier about your mother's oral history and you had transcribed it, when you were listening to your mother's oral history or recording of it over a period of time to take notes, or yes, you had to transcribe, but I'm sure you would also listen occasionally. Did it hit you emotionally more hearing your mom's voice than just reading the transcript?
That's a really great question, because it changed depending on when I tried. So when I first watched the tape, I didn't like it at all. And I felt, and that's because my mother was quite formal and ill at ease. And I sensed that it was hard for her to go back in time to that part in her life. And I felt guilty that I had urged her to do it.
But this was both video then and audio. It wasn't just audio.
No, it was audio. It was a video. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And she might've been more relaxed just doing an audio version where she doesn't have to worry about being on camera.
But just, I don't think so, because she wouldn't let me do an audio interview, and I tried several times to do it. But
I take back my suggestion. Not that it matters, but some people are just more nervous on camera versus if they have a microphone in front of them, but in this case, not. When you put it all together, and I alluded to it in my opening remarks, that there's a lot to unpack with this book and the documentary in terms of lessons learned and things never to forget. What would you want people to take away from reading this book and seeing the documentary?
I very much want people of all walks of life to read my book and see the film, because even though their family members may not have experienced the kind of persecution and hounding that my relatives did, we are at a point in history where similar things are starting to happen again. There are 123 million refugees on the planet right now, people who are displaced. They're called displaced by the UN High Commission for Refugees. And as we know, they often are in great danger when they try to leave their countries and find a haven elsewhere. And that is why I talked about what happened to my father not being able to get off the ship and what would have happened to him if he had been sent back. And I would like people to have empathy for the plights of people in dire straits, because we have to find a way to be tolerant of one another. If we're not careful, pretty much everyone on the planet will know someone who's experienced tremendous trauma because they have no place to go. And that's not healthy for all of us. And I feel that if you know the details of what happened to one family, the individuals in one family like mine, as opposed to statistics, people are more likely to care and find empathy and see that this does not continue and happen to other people.
So I think also too, though, you have to balance that out with, you have to have some vetting of people coming into a country, because there could be criminals or terrorists coming in. So there has to be a balance of empathy, but also the old Reagan quote, trust but verify. In other words, you can't just open it up to just anybody that comes in, because then there's no validation of who's who. You could certainly know a difference between your father, who was a doctor, and someone who's a terrorist coming in or under false identity. You know, the Nazis after World War II came to Argentina under different identities and went to Brazil under different. So there's that balance that they were not vetted. Right. So that's why I bring up a balancing point to what you were just saying. But when you went to the point where you had finished enough research and wrote the book and did the documentary, did you find after it was all completed that there was another piece that all of a sudden appeared through serendipity or through randomness, as you mentioned earlier, that you said, oh, I should have added that, but I didn't know at the time, which everybody knows, it's hindsight. But is there something that came up that you said, yes, this would be good for part two or a sequel or an addendum?
There were two discoveries that were made while we were in production on the film. And I added them to the book because the manuscript was still not finalized. And one was very, very important. And I had avoided this search. As I mentioned, my father was one of three boys, and there was a younger sibling, my lost uncle, whose death I knew a little bit about from my mother. And his name was Milek. And my older sister, Michelle, said that she thought she remembered being told that his wife, he was newlywed, was pregnant when she and my grandmother were found out. And my grandmother had been given a vial of cyanide. So when the Gestapo stormed up the steps to arrest her after Milek had visited his wife, he was working as an engineer in a factory as a slave engineer, but he came home because he missed his bride, and he was followed. So the next day, the Gestapo came to get them. They were posing as Catholics because they were both blonde and blue-eyed, and my grandmother took the cyanide, but my aunt by marriage did not, and cradled or gestured as if she were cradling a baby. So this whole episode was extremely painful to think about, and I put off something I had in the back of my mind, which was that I had discovered in my mother's files a folder that came from the University of Vienna and was a record of my father's medical school days. And it had a photograph of him, and it listed the classes that he took and who his professors were. Finally, while we were in post-production, so I guess it was the summer of 22 or 23, I decided that Uncle Milek must have a similar document from his days at Lvov Polytechnic, where he had studied engineering. And so I asked Alex, the guide and researcher, to find out if there was a dossier on him. And he was so infuriated. He told me, the archivist there is a typical apparatchnik and has delayed and isn't cooperating and won't, you know. And then the archivist demanded that I pay, but sent me the bill in Ukrainian. So I had to send it back to Alex to find out what it said. And then I finally paid. But he persisted, because even though she said it didn't exist, he said, I know it exists. I've seen it in an index. And there I saw a photograph of my uncle in 1941. And he had to fill out a form when he applied, and it included my grandfather's occupation at the time, and his bride's name and her father's occupation. And it said that my family had been thrown out of the house, the beautiful house with the majolical tiles, when the Soviets took over Lvov in September of 1939. So that was a wealth of information. And then I realized that the house that I had seen and was so thrilled to find, and the steps that I had walked up were not the steps that the Gestapo had stormed up to get my grandmother and my aunt, that they had stormed up the steps of another house. So I went on a tear looking for it, and it turned out to have been destroyed and paved over and was part of a courtyard of some modern building. And that was very important. That was a very important find. One message I really would like readers to take away, and also audiences for the film, is the importance of resistance. Because what I learned on my journey is that there are many ways to resist fascism and to resist the Nazis. So, for example, when my grandmother took the poison, I for many years couldn't accept it. And I always wondered, what if she hadn't? Maybe she would have survived the concentration camps. But she was going to decide for herself how to die. And that was her last act of free will. And that was resistance. And my grandparents sending my mother away at the age of 17, because it was too dangerous where they were, sending her back west to Poland, which was completely counterintuitive. That was resistance. Parting with their only child was a type of resistance. And we can make statements through our actions and not be bystanders as well.
Well, that's a great way to leave it. My guest has been Karen A. Frankel. She's author of Family Treasures Lost and Found. It's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all the usual places. For everything about not only the book, but the documentary as well, go to FamilyTreasuresMemoir.com, FamilyTreasuresMemoir.com, and FamilyTreasuresFilm.com, FamilyTreasuresFilm.com. And Karen, thanks for being on the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
And join us every Thursday for a new schmear on Ira's Everything Bagel.